Well, welcome, everyone. I'm Jennifer Cook. I'm director of the Africa program here at CSIS. And we're very happy to welcome Jonathan Fisher today. Jonathan is a postdoctoral research fellow at the International Development Department at Birmingham University. He's a doctor of philosophy who's focused really on the relationship between the Ugandan government and international aid donors, and now more broadly, I think, on the relationship between donors and East Africa broadly. He's writing his research currently on how those relationships are changing in the wake of 9/11, how Kenyan and Ugandans, for example, are shaping U.S. perceptions and how U.S. perceptions have changed towards those countries in U.S. policies. I think it's worth noting that post 9/11 was a change in the relationship, not only, I think, because of the security relationship. I think some of the glow was fading on the Ugandan model and so forth, and big things were happening in Kenya at the same time. So kind of pulling those two apart, what changed because of 9/11, what has changed because of other things, and how were those relationships managed is important. So he's here in the United States talking to U.S. policymakers and others kind of in the donor community and the security arena. And I assume you've been doing the same in the EU among the EU donors. Yeah. What Jonathan's going to do is talk for 15 minutes or so, talk about his findings, his research and findings. But as I said, we want to make this interactive. So I think he's looking too to hear people's views, push back in your perceptions and so forth. We'll keep this informal and interactive. And Jonathan, welcome. We're
Thank
really
you.
Glad to have you. It's an interesting topic.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Well, thank you very much, Jennifer. And thank you also to David and to Farha for sort of inviting me along and facilitating this discussion. And thank you to all of you for coming along. It's very useful for academics to be able to present their research before people who know about the subject, and you seem like a informed and distinguished audience from your initial comments, so I look forward to hearing your comments. Before I start, I'd just like to acknowledge some funding I've received from the International Development Department at Birmingham to attend, to come to Washington to do this research, and also from the University of Oxford from my sort of doctoral work and the ESRC in the UK. So lots of people have given me moderate amounts of money to undertake this research, so hopefully there'll be something that comes of it. Just as a sort of introduction to where I'm coming from, my interest in Africa has been over a long period, but when I was starting my doctoral work, the main question which sort of interested me was, why is it that Western donors, and when I say donors, I mean mainly the US and the UK, those are the countries I sort of concentrated on. They're also the most prominent bilateral donors to both Uganda and Kenya, as far as I know still. Why have these Western donors been so supportive of the Ugandan government, supportive in terms of financial support, military assistance, but also diplomatic support in terms of, visits, incorporating the government into regional and international frameworks and structures? Why have they been so supportive of the Ugandan government in spite of its various transgressions in terms of governance, democratisation, and regional conflict to some extent? In spite of the fact that obviously US-UK rhetoric has generally been opposed to these sort of democratic backsliding, regional belligerence, but also their actions elsewhere have been contradictory. So if you look at the way donors were with Kenya, Malawi in the 1990s, or maybe Zambia, and compare those to the way donors behave to Uganda, there's quite a contrast in terms of perhaps more criticism and more sort of threats to suspend aid, etc., to other countries than Uganda. So why has this been the case? And clearly it's related to Uganda's reputation internationally as a neoliberal reformer, as an HIV success story, or at least it was, as a regional guarantor of stability, and as a Western ally in the global war on terror, or whatever it's called now.
We don't call it that anymore.
No, sort of operation something or other. Yeah. But I'm going to say war on terror anyway, just to for sort of ease of conceptual discourse. But obviously these sort of reputations are their perceptions. They're perceptions that policymakers have of the Ugandan government. They're not necessarily factual reality. So if you look at Uganda's image as a sort of guarantor of regional stability and then look at its involvement in Congo in the 90s or in Sudan or in Rwanda in the 90s, there's a different image that you could potentially create in terms of its slightly more belligerent regional involvement. So I wanted to explore where these sort of perceptions and narratives came from, where they've come from and how they've been sustained. And in doing this, I've looked especially at the role of the Ugandan government itself, and particularly at the role of President Museveni and his major advisers, and how they've used various techniques, including personal diplomacy, presentations at foreign policy institutes such as this, although I don't think he's actually spoken at CSIS.
Once he has.
Oh, okay, all right. Well, maybe I used that in my research as well. engagement with sort of media houses, media agencies, lobbying firms, as well as actual concrete policy actions themselves, such as involvement in Somalia, and how it's used those to mould, shape and perpetuate these narratives to the sort of extent of stopping other narratives becoming more prominent. And I've called this image management, maybe somewhat flippantly, but that's the way I've sort of described it in my research. What I'm going to talk about today over the next 10 minutes or so is looking particularly at this perception of Uganda as an ally in the global war on terror, and comparing and contrasting that to the sort of image of Kenya. And this is going to be a sort of semi-historical discussion. I'm conscious of the Kenyan presence, so maybe things have changed in more recent years. But I'm looking at the period since 9/11, mainly. And from interviews with UK and US officials, and also looking at releases from the WikiLeaks cables, public comments, policy actions, it seems that since 9/11, particularly until about 2007-2008, Uganda has been seen as much more in a much more positive light in terms of security cooperation and its commitment to the global war on terror than Kenya. Some of you may disagree, and clearly this isn't a universal perception. And I haven't really got a huge amount of time to sort of justify that assertion, fortunately or unfortunately. But if you have a look, for example, at the annual assessments on counterterrorism, which the State Department produces, you can see an obvious contrast where Uganda is often described as having, quote, a firm stance against international terrorism, whereas Kenya, at least in the mid-2000s, has been criticised for making, quote, slow or, quote, no progress in this regard and for being, quote, uneven in its level of cooperation. So there's a contrast that you can see in the sort of public discourse, but also in the sort of private interviews that I've had with current and former UK and US officials. Some have described their sort of distrust of Kenyan security officials, and the WikiLeaks cables have attacked the Kenyan government's lackluster counterterrorism performance and lethargic approach to the issue. But if you contrast that to the cables on Uganda and Museveni's government, they're characterised as fully cooperative and responsive and committed. So there's an obvious contrast there. But this is in spite of the fact that on the face of it, looking at the sort of facts, if you can talk about them, be facts, Kenyan and Ugandan cooperation during the war on terror, I think, has largely been of the same magnitude. So they've both been heavily involved in domestic and regional security frameworks, both heavily involved in the sort of Somalia issue from various different perspectives. They've worked closely with FBI personnel on the ground, cracked down on sort of Islamist civil society or other groups, for better or worse. Kenya has failed to pass anti-terror legislation, or at least comprehensive anti-terror legislation, but that isn't necessarily because the government didn't want to. That was more a result of domestic problems. So I'd say that there's a kind of disconnect here between the way in which donors have viewed Kenya and Uganda in terms of their cooperation and the reality on the ground. And this is important because it's had what I would say are real consequences for donor relationships with those countries. So if you look at the aid levels, for example, Uganda's received more US aid until 2006 than Kenya, in spite of the fact that it's a much smaller country and it's much less strategically important, if you want to see it that way. In 2003, George W. Bush cancelled a trip to Kenya at the last minute for security reasons. That would have been the first trip by US president to Kenya. There hasn't been one since. Uganda's had two And Uganda was also on the itinerary. So that, even though there's no direct sort of effects of that, it's quite humiliating from an international perspective, and it sends messages about what the US sort of intends or thinks about Kenya, whether or not it's actually true. And generally, I think there's been more leniency shown by donors towards Uganda in terms of its domestic policies, corruption, governance that I've already talked about, than Kenya. And you can look at, for example, the recent way in which the US has addressed corrupt officials in Kenya compared to those in Uganda, where there have been travel bans and public criticism in the Kenyan version, but in Uganda, no public comments whatsoever and no private actions either, where the levels of corruption, I would say, are completely comparable and going up to the senior level in both cases. So in trying to explain why these contrasting perceptions have arisen and why, at least until about 2007, 2008, they've remained so salient in policy-making circles, I'm arguing that a major explanation can be found in Uganda's successful image management strategies in contrast to Kenya's. So turning to Uganda, since 9/11, the Ugandan government has presented itself as a major donor ally in the global war on terror through a variety of means, so supporting the war in Iraq, involving itself in Somalia. But today I want to briefly discuss another strategy, which is the way in which it's presented its domestic rebel groups. And by this I mean the LRA, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, and the...
Yeah,
the Kony people, and the ADF, which is the Allied Democratic Forces, a kind of mainly Muslim coalition of anti-Museveni forces, which are now not really operative. The way in which it's portrayed these domestic rebel groups in terms of them being terrorists, and in doing this, it's tried to position itself as at the centre of the global war on terror, just as affected as the US, also fighting in this same war and sort of... at the heart of the sort of the terrorism conflict. So it's publicly recast the LRA and the ADF as terrorists. Prior to 2001, if you look at Museveni's speeches, the way in which they were spoken about, both publicly and privately, they would be described as criminals or bandits or troublemakers or other words to kind of show them as being not very important, incidental. Whereas since then, particularly before US audiences, they've always been described as terrorists. And in doing this, it's also the Ugandan government's tried to stress the linkages between these groups and al-Qaeda more generally, whether or not those links have been credible. They've also tried in private discussions with donors to always move the subject of discussion towards the LRA and towards the terrorism issue. So I spoke to one former donor official who had a number of meetings with Museveni and with his officials during the 2000s, and they basically said that whenever they tried to discuss anything, the conversation would be moved towards the LRA and the threat posed by them and the centrality of the terrorist threat to Uganda. And that has an effect on the way that donor policymakers see Uganda, whether or not they accept what the counterpart is saying. If they're always talking about it, it seems pretty important. The government of Uganda has also successfully lobbied for the inclusion of these groups on the State Department's terrorist exclusion list, and regime officials have frequently tried to highlight these groups' presence on this list in Washington and London. So kind of saying, you guys recognise that these groups are terrorists, so you know they're as bad as al-Qaeda or they're linked to them. There's a kind of closeness there. And one of its other strategies has been trying to keep reminding donors of Uganda's own war on terror through stressing the LRA and ADF's continued operations and the continued threat to Uganda. Because in order to sustain the idea that Uganda is at the heart of the war on terror, they've also had to make sure that the LRA and the ADF threat remain salient. So there's a story from 2008 put out by the Ugandan Interior Ministry where they basically said that they'd foiled an ADF plot to blow up the Queen at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, which was sort of a way of saying, you know, they're still there, they're still operating, they're still posing a real threat. That wasn't really picked up by the UK media, which I'm not sure what that says about their trust of this source, but it's indicative at least of the Ugandan government's continued strategy. That it's been successful in linking these two issues in donor minds is clear, again, if you look at State Department terrorism reports, which largely focus on the LRA and the ADF when they're talking about counter-terrorism in Uganda. And critically in these reports, they're placing the emphasis on Kampala's successful operations against these groups and its commitment to eliminating them. So it's not just Uganda is under threat from terrorism, but it's also fighting back. It's trying to eliminate these groups, so showing a commitment and reliability in fighting terrorism. Turning to Kenya, from what I've seen, there's little evidence that the Kibaki administration or his sort of security team have made a similar effort to manage how they're seen by donors in relation to counterterrorism, at least until about 2008. They've engaged much less with US or UK media houses, policy institutes on security matters, and have generally been reactive in their policy stances and actions as opposed to proactive. So there were a spate of sort of counterterrorism arrests in 2007, but this was only after public criticism from Washington over the sort of lack of progress in this area. So there's sort of a criticism from Washington and then action, whereas in Uganda it might be the other way around. Kibaki himself has been unable and perhaps unwilling to organise his ministerial team behind a united approach to dealing with donors, trying to put forward a common message, and has frequently made himself unavailable to quite senior US and UK counterparts for security meetings right at the last minute. So, I mean, this does, again, have an effect on the way policymakers see his government, because if you've come all the way from London or from Washington expecting to have an audience with the president and he cancels at the last minute, then that sends messages about how reliable that government can be, even if you then do get a chance to speak to the security minister or whoever. And I've spoken to lots of officials who've told me that they or their boss or, you know, someone else senior was going to meet with Kibaki and the meeting was cancelled at the last minute. And that sends messages, I think. The Kenyan administration's somewhat uncoordinated nature, I think, has also led to major counterterrorism pledges and priorities being dropped or at least miscommunicated, further damaging Nairobi's image. So an example from 2008, and this is from WikiLeaks again, where Kenyan officials at IGAD and at the Foreign Ministry simultaneously announced completely contradictory information about Kenya's intentions for sending peacekeepers into Somalia. And if you're at the State Department or at the Foreign Office and you're getting these two separate pieces of information, how are you meant to reconcile them, and what does that tell you? What does that make you think about the way in which Kenya operates in terms of its security priorities? As well as appearing perhaps incompetent, the Kenyan government has also damaged its reputation in donor minds on security through some kind of petulant public and private responses to donor comments. So there was an attack at the UN by, I think, the then Kenyan foreign minister on US policy in Iraq in 2003. There's also a story that one of my interviewees has told me about. I won't say where he or she or them are from, but they were ignored for 6 months by their Kenyan counterpart, who was quite senior in the cabinet, over disagreements on counterterrorism. So if you can't, if you're being ignored by your counterpart in the government, you can't deal with these bilateral issues, again, that sends messages. As I've alluded to, there's quite a good degree of evidence that the Kenyan government has paid greater attention to how the US and others see it since around 2007. And I think this is no doubt in relation to the Somalia issue and how that has changed the dynamic of the US-Kenyan relationship. I would nevertheless maintain that these more negative perspectives on Kenyan reliability, at least from a donor perspective, can to a considerable degree be explained by Uganda and Museveni's more skillful use of image management strategies. If you will indulge me for a couple more minutes, is that all right?
Yes.
I've just got a couple of final thoughts on explaining why that is, because that's an obvious question, saying these things about the way in which US and UK perceive Kenya and Uganda, why have they behaved differently in terms of trying to promote themselves? I would say that there are probably three major reasons why, arguably, they've done this. First of all, Uganda is much more dependent and has been historically much more dependent on international aid than Kenya. I think Uganda currently, I think about 30 to 35% of its budget is funded by donors. I don't know the figure for Kenya, but I wouldn't think it's more than 1 or 2% or something like that.
It's about 6 or 7%.
Okay, all right. So, but again, quite a difference. So from some perspectives, Kenya doesn't need the support of the international community to quite the same degree. There's that phrase about necessity being the mother of invention, and I think that's quite salient for looking at this particular issue. There's also the fact that Kenya is a lot more democratic than Uganda is. And in order to maintain power in Kenya, you need to assemble a sort of coalition of different groups from different ethnic and regional backgrounds. Whereas in Uganda, it's not really like that at all. So in order so I think in Kenya there's been much more of a fear at the highest levels of alienating the particularly the Muslim population on the sort of coast by being perceived as too close to US regional policy. The Muslim population, I think, is about 15% of the Kenyan population, and I think a slightly higher percentage of the electorate. And in the last election, they were seen as a sort of swing group of voters. So that's important for the higher echelons of Kenyan political parties not to alienate this group. Although I can talk about this a bit later, but from what I can see, the Kibaki administration has not succeeded in appeasing this group. Whatever it's tried to do, it certainly is not seen by Muslim voters as being distant from the US, quite the opposite. I'd finally point to the different sociologies of the two governments. The Museveni regime grew out of this sort of centralised, disciplined, personalised guerrilla group, united around one leader, one programme, one sort of common purpose. And I think this is translated into its approach to government, its approach to foreign policy. The Kibaki government is completely different. As I said, it's sort of come together through this coalition of sometimes groups that disagree with each other, groups which can easily pull out of the coalition. It's sort of inherently unstable. And in order to maintain a kind of common message in such a dispensation, that's a lot more difficult. You have to get a lot of groups on board, whereas in Uganda it's much easier to kind of streamline a narrative. And finally, I'd point towards also the fact that Museveni personally is simply more energetic, more strategic from both a military and political point of view, and simply better from what I've heard from people that have met with both of them at engaging with Western officials and Western donor and diplomatic officials than Kibaki. And I think this personal element is important and shouldn't be overlooked, because a lot of the way people form their perceptions of governments, particularly at the higher levels, is their sort of brief half an hour, 20-minute meeting with their counterpart. So I think the fact that Museveni is better, more strategic in that way is also important. But I think I'll leave it there and look forward to hearing your comments, criticisms, etc.
Great. Well, very interesting and kind of thought-provoking. Maybe I'll start and then open it up to questions. I mean, Uganda has always had something of a privileged relationship. I mean, I think along with Melis, along with Kagame, along with and Museveni, each kind of were credited with bringing an end to real violent chaos in their countries. And, you know, the new leader embrace, the new leader label preceded 9/11 and even 98. So, I mean, there was this kind of understanding. I think people have been slow to then grasp the implications of that is one thing. the other thing is that Uganda hasn't had the immediate threat. It had the bombing at the club, the opening club, but not the kind of attack that Kenya had, and not just in 98, but subsequent attacks. And it's messy dealing with kind of those issues, particularly in a more democratic society. And I think it's not simply holding a coalition together, but there were genuine voices in civil society, you know, when the FBI came in with fairly heavy-handed tactics after 98, pushing for this Patriot Act-type legislation. I think it wasn't just holding a coalition together. There were, you know, real questions about what does the suspension of habeas corpus and so forth mean. The other thing, and I don't mean to be a Kenya defender in this, I feel... but I tend to think that the U.S. in some ways takes Kenya for granted. I mean, it actually has had a long and strong security relationship with Kenya, with, you know, air base rights and ports, and it's been a transshipment corridor for assistance into Sudan, into Congo, into Rwanda, and so forth. So there is a tendency to take it for granted, and that I think sets the bar a little higher on Kenya, not only in the security realm, but also in corruption issues and governance issues. I think, you know, more is expected of Kenya in some ways on that. But you know, I think you're very right that you know, Uganda, and you could add a couple of other countries to that, have been much more strategic in shaping it. One of the things, like you said, it's the one voice that speaks in Uganda. There's one voice that has authority. In Kenya, in fact, there are many.
Yes.
So actually, you know, that's just to comment on what you've said, and I wonder perhaps, and take a few questions, how you think Kenya's engagement in Somalia might change some of this.
Mm-hmm.
But why don't we take a couple and then come back to you.
Okay.
Sarah?
Thank you so much. Fascinating. Thanks. I think you gave a very clear explanation of sort of maybe the supply side, you know, why this is the way it is in Kenya and Uganda. But I'm wondering maybe more on the demand side. I mean, why do we fall for it? You know, why we all know what the LRA is and what the LRA isn't. You know, do you have any insights? Because I know, just as somebody who's an advocate here in D.C., before the Ugandan elections, I had a really hard time breaking that narrative of the bastion of stability in a region of chaos, you know, whole narrative. And it's just, it stymies me. Why?
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Doug.
Just to follow up on your Somalia point, the U.S. has actually had a fairly tight relationship with the Ugandans regarding Somalia, and certainly in the field, certainly in the training side and so on. So I think it's but the other thing about that that's really remarkable to me is how open the Ugandans have been to allowing journalists and others to come in and see what they're doing. They're very proud of that sort of thing, whereas I've seen far less on the Kenya incursion.
Okay.
And I'd be interested in your take on that.
Okay, that's interesting.
Should we start there and then go back to Lauren?
Okay, right. That's an interesting, to Doug's point, I think I'll go in reverse. The Ugandan journalist's point is an interesting one, although I would perhaps contrast that with the access that media agencies have had to eastern Uganda and the oil sort of fields. From what I've heard, they wouldn't even let sort of diplomats anywhere near eastern Uganda. So there's an issue there of kind of selective allowance of what Western journalists are allowed to see. And that's also been the case in Rwanda as well. You mentioned Kagame. He's called himself the master of media something or other. I haven't got the quote with me, but it's an interesting and revealing one, where they've managed the way in which journalists have been able to access certain sort of sites and not others. I think that's quite an interesting argument. I've actually written a paper on the international context to Uganda's involvement in Somalia, so I definitely agree with your point about the US being involved for a long time. I've got a few copies of it here, if anyone would like to see them, but it's going to be an African Affairs journal, and that should be coming out, I think, in the next few days, the sort of early view thing. To your point about the supply side, I think this is something which I've found difficult to understand as well, because diplomats and donor officials, many of which I've interviewed and some of which are here, they're not stupid. In fact, they're very intelligent. They generally understand the sort of nuances of diplomacy and politics, especially if they're in country. But it's true that at certain levels you can't break through this sort of narratives. And what I guess I would put that down to is the fact that, particularly when you're dealing with, you know, if you're an assistant secretary or a director for a large region, you don't have the time to gather as much information as you might want to about individual countries, and you have these sort of priorities, these sort of policy agendas and priorities coming down from the White House or your boss or whatever. So I think you have to try and kind of balance those things, and I guess somehow within that process you end up sticking to sort of certain narratives about these countries. You know, what do you know about Burkina Faso? I know this and this. And if you see things which kind of support those assumptions, then that sort of builds into the process. But I guess it's a kind of psychological thing which I'm not an expert on, but would like to do more work into. I guess that's the way in which policymaking works, I suppose, would be the answer to your question, which is not to say that they don't, that particularly at the lower levels of diplomacy, not to say that they don't understand, you know, the dynamics and the nuances.
The one thing I'd add to that is looking at the U.S. Congress, which is more... I wouldn't say they're not intelligent, but they're more captive to simplified
definitely.
Narratives, especially I think when it comes to places like Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
Museveni is very skillful in that. Mm-hmm. I think has played on kind of the work on HIV/AIDS, but also the work, the kind of religious groups within mm-hmm. Rwanda that mm-hmm. have a lot of, congressional links there.
Yeah.
They've made very solid personal links with mm-hmm. both the Clinton administration and the Bush administration.
Yes.
This administration, I tend to think, is maybe a little less, captured by Museveni's mm-hmm. personality. I mean, that's just my
judgment. I would agree
judgment.
With that, yeah.
But, so I think Congress is something mm-hmm. you need to look at since they have to hold the purse strings in the end.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I looked at during my sort of doctoral research, and it is very interesting to look at the work of certain lobbying groups and their sort of donations to certain, congressmen or senators or whatever, and then what kind of legislation comes up. There's an interesting, I think, act or I don't know what you call them here. The bills?
Bill.
Yeah, where there's a kind of preamble talking about the LRA and the threat to Uganda. And there's quite an interesting backstory about how that came into being and the lobbying back and forth between one particular Ugandan agency, Ugandan lobbying firm and various legislators. I won't give any names. But you can kind of find out if you read my thesis, where they kind of try to influence the language and emphasise, the sort of the threat from the LRA. So there is certainly sort of a congressional aspect to this as well. And I would agree that it's more easy to link the sort of the cravenness of politics to it. To the other points.
Should we go? I think Lauren had one. We'll go to Fruit, Ben Scott.
This is Lauren Plott from Congress. Given the sort of regional leadership role that Museveni has put himself in on Somalia, on counterterrorism, also on the LRA, his recent outreach with Isaias, how do you see the bellicose rhetoric that's coming out of Kampala right now towards Khartoum? And obviously there are long histories and affinities between the SPLA and Museveni mm-hmm. and NRM, but he's going quite far and a bit out on a limb. Given the role that EGAD played.
Towards Khartoum, did you say? Okay.
David?
I think we have to perhaps disaggregate. I think there is the role that the governments play, specifically in the old war on terror. And then I think there is the more military dimension, particularly in Somalia, mm-hmm. But of course in Uganda's case, in the DRC and perhaps incursions into southern Sudan in the past. And I think those provoke very different responses. Part of Kenya's problem is that we know it far too well. That there are far too many Western journalists in Nairobi who scour the woods for minor divisions and perceptions, which then perhaps get blown up. And Kenya is a much, much more diversified and complex society than Uganda and indeed Ethiopia, where there is, as you say, a much more monochrome perception of state power, more absolutist perception of state power.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to the military, the story is very different. The Kenyan military have never really done anything, and they are perceived as small and weak.
Mm.
Whereas the Ugandans have tromped all over the DRC. The Ethiopians have, pushed out the Derg, but also tromped around Somalia. That these are experienced, large armies, although in fact total military expenditure in Kenya is actually more than Uganda right. and Ethiopia combined. So we have a paradox here. But it does seem to me that the fundamental problem of Kenyan image is partly a function of the Kibaki state, but I think it's more a function of the nature that we are actually dealing with a complex democracy. Mm-hmm. I know from personal experience that when the legislation for a comprehensive anti-terrorist legislation was being mooted by the Kenyan government, the two members of the Kenyan cabinet, who are friends of mine, were actually talking to civil society and saying, why the hell aren't you guys making more of a fuss about this legislation? Because we don't really want it. It's being crammed down our throats by the Americans. And we're just going through the processes of trying to meet their requirements. But we see it as an invidious invasion of democratic rights and respect for human rights in Kenya. And the Kenyan government is not particularly enthusiastic. We can't say to the Americans no, but if you guys get your act together, we would actually be quite pleased if he died a natural death in Parliament, which, of course, is what happened.
Yeah.
So it's the nature of the Kenyan state, I think, is the fundamental difference.
Mm-hmm.
First is about the status between the difference between the LRA and the ADF. Why is there a more emphasis by Museveni to get international help to rein in the LRA when they haven't been in Uganda since 2005, as opposed to the ADF, which are allegedly reforming in the DRC and in late December actually broke 100 of their fighters out of jail? And as a segue into the segues into my next part of my question is, based on your research in Washington and London, how do they view the threat of the ADF toward Uganda in both capitals?
Okay, if you'd like to take this. Okay. As far as I can tell, no one in London or Washington has any opinion on the ADF. they don't. So from that, I guess I could gather that they don't see it as a threat at all. I think one of the problems is that there doesn't seem to be much concrete information about the ADF, and there hasn't been over the last 5 or 6 years. Quite a lot of the stories will say that they're just reduced to a rump and they're not doing anything. Others will say that they're regrouping. But I haven't come across anyone that's particularly worried about the ADF. And I think that, I mean, how would I explain the fact that Museveni in Uganda emphasises the LRA more than the ADF? I guess because the LRA is more prevalent, or has been more consistently prevalent, not only in Uganda but regionally. The ADF has kind of gone through phases. It was quite sort of prominent in 2000, 2001, then it kind of went away again and then came back 2004, 2005, and now it's kind of, no one's really sure what's going on. It sounds like you are a bit more informed than I am on its current activities. But I think because the LRA has been so horrific in terms of what it's done, and it's been so persistent as well, I think it's much easier to craft a narrative around that sort of a group, because it's been there for such a long time. Why are they concentrating on it now that it's not in Uganda? I guess I don't think that Museveni is particularly worried about the threat to Uganda posed by the LRA. I don't think he was ever worried about that, even whilst they were in Uganda. But I think, to be honest, I would probably go back to what Lauren was saying about the sort of regional aspect, that the Ugandan government has, particularly Museveni, has long seen itself as wanting to have a kind of hegemonic regional role, to be a kind of Nyerere-type figure who is the big statesman and sort of to get everyone goes to in Central Eastern Africa. So I think that they see the LRA as a way of kind of expanding their regional military influence, because they sort of had cooperation with the DRC and the Southern Sudanese military. And I think, and quite often they've said, whether or not donors support us, we're going to go across the border and deal with them. And I think that's quite a good way of increasing your presence in Central Africa, at least having a sort of legitimate, in inverted commas, reason to do it. I think that what you were saying, David, about disaggregating the military and the global war on terror is quite an interesting point. And I think I'll have to think about it rather whilst I'm going over this kind of research. It's interesting what you were saying about your your colleagues, your cabinet minister colleagues, because I'm trying to get my head around whether there is this kind of Kenyan double game in terms of saying one thing to the domestic audience and saying another thing to the donors. Because, you know, from some perspectives, these chaps may have been saying this to civil society groups in order to make, you know, those groups think that the Kenyan government was concerned about the Muslim sort of issue, whereas in talking to donors they were saying, oh God, you know, these civil society groups, they're awful, they can't, they're not letting us do anything, we really want to pass this legislation but you just can't do it. So if that's the case, then it shows a quite interesting dynamic to Kenya's management of its sort of public image, and in some respects that would make it quite skillful. Although I would argue that they've managed to satisfy neither the Muslim constituents nor the donors, so not necessarily that skillful. And finally, just on the Khartoum Sudan point, Uganda's had quite a long history, Museveni personally, of being opposed to Khartoum and very supportive of southern Sudan. And I think that the Museveni regime sees itself as quite kind of central to the future of southern Sudan. And I don't think, even though they sort of had peace with Khartoum since the like early 2000s, I think they would welcome the opportunity to take part in some sort of regional kind of peacekeeping or sort of trying to resolve any particular tension by, again, increasing their influence as mediators. In the same way that Moi tried to when Uganda was having, you know, a civil war in the mid to late 80s. So I think, again, it's part of the kind of trying to ratchet up the rhetoric, but at the same time positioning itself as someone who can help and step in and try and resolve tensions. I don't think that he'll win the Nobel Peace Prize, but yeah.
Good. Yes, Kenya, and then Richard, and then
Leslie. Thank you very much, Dr. Fisher, for that presentation. Just one thing before I make my comment. The gentleman here said something, and with all respect, you said that the Kenyan military have not done anything so far. So I don't know what you'd like them to have done. No, I would like, maybe I would like to know what they should have done before this. I don't know what that should have been. If you, maybe in your research, when you're looking at all these things, Kenya, as compared to Uganda, because we are talking of two countries, you're looking at one country which has suffered more in terms of terrorism than another. And you're talking of Kenya, which is actually a frontline state with Somali, and where we have Somalis on either side. So the levels of engagement with the international community definitely are not bound to be the same, I mean, in terms of how you're looking at issues. And Kenya per se, the democratic space, you know, is such a large democratic space. And therefore, you are saying that you are bound to hear more things, people say talking more, than maybe in maybe Uganda and so on. But if you look at things, the way they are focused, if the government is saying something, they are saying it with one voice. But you may hear people make various comments here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so that does not mean that we are not, there is no, you know, one line, one trajectory that has been taken up, on a given specific, you know, way of looking at things. So I think where we are coming from and where we are and where we are going, for the two countries, might explain maybe the difference in our approach of
okay.
things. Thank you.
Richard?
Just interested in your explanation why you think the Ugandan military has decided to get involved in Somalia. As our colleague from Kenya says, you know, it's not, Uganda isn't on the doorstep of Somalia, and you know, by getting involved in the AMISOM mission, they've exposed not only their military to great threat, but also their civilian population with the attacks you saw in Kampala. Is it purely to look good and look useful in terms of counterterrorism on the international stage, or is it a means of keeping the military well paid that could pose a threat to Museveni? I'm just interested in your explanation.
I just wanted to pick up Yes, sir.
I'd like to hear your comments on whether the Kenyan operation in Somalia will change the relationship with donors.
Okay. All right. Quite a lot of questions.
Yes, sorry. First was kind of a comment. But
yes, yeah. I think in terms of the Kenyan intervention in Somalia, at the moment, I can't tell the future, but I suspect if it turns out well, the operation, then it could certainly change things. I think the fact that the Kenyan intervention, from what I've heard, wasn't kind of done in collaboration with the US or with Western partners made Western partners sort of slightly surprised initially, and that may have sort of put it on the wrong footing, whereas obviously in Uganda it was part of a sort of AU, UN, much more sort of systematic structure. I think the thing which is more likely to change the relationship between Kenya and donors, though, is the election and whoever ends up as the next president. I think Raila Odinga, who I think is currently in the lead by about 10 points or something, but you never really know with Kenyan polls, as 2007 showed. He has been compared to Museveni and this new generation of leaders by people I've spoken to in terms of his engagement with Western sort of ways of thinking and ways of doing things. And he's quite dynamic and energetic. And I suspect that his election, if it happens, will change the nature of the relationship as much, if not more, than the Somalia intervention. If Kenyatta gets in, then I really have no idea how that will affect things, but it would certainly be interesting from an academic perspective. Why has Uganda become involved in Somalia? And you can read my paper if you like. I would certainly say that the international sort of image management stuff is important, but clearly it's not the only thing, and trying to find something for the Ugandan military to do has been a big aspect, because sort of they returned from Congo in about 2003, 2004, so the kind of you have this large group of soldiers recently back from the war. They sort of pose a potential threat to stability, and I think that that is an important thing to sort of keep them occupied, give them something to do. There's also the sort of regional hegemony aspect, and I think Museveni himself has personally had quite an interest in Somalia for quite a long time. He was apparently chair of the AU or whatever it was called then, when 1993 and the whole sort of problems in Somalia started, and since then he has apparently felt the sort of personal mission of his to try and resolve the issue. So I think that there's also, you have to distinguish between the reasons that they went in and the reasons that they're still there, and I think that maybe the international aspect was quite important for going in, but now I think it's evolved into a much more kind of a mission type thing for the Ugandan government.
Can I just ask, internally in Uganda, what's the kind of support for or opposition to the deployment, or is it hard to...
It is hard to gauge because the media is quite heavily controlled, although there is one quite independent, called The Independent, magazine, and there's a sort of independent newspaper as well. I think that the perspectives changed after the Kampala bombing. I think initially people were kind of like, couldn't really understand why Uganda was going in there, and the opposition was kind of opposed to it as well. But since the Kampala bombing, people have been much more supportive. And I think also the fact that for whatever sort of machinations went into AMISOM happening and why Uganda became involved, it does actually seem to have been pretty successful in what it aimed to do. So I guess there's sort of that has led to a greater degree of support in Ugandan society and political sort of world as well, from what I can tell from speaking to people. Could you just address the comments from the Kenyan embassy? I'm grateful to you for your comments, and particularly as may not have been particularly pleasant to hear what some of the things I was saying, so thank you for your respectful and constructive response. I think that this issue of the fact that Kenya has suffered more from terrorism is an interesting and important one. But I think the thing which I find curious is just that Kenya has been a lot more affected directly by terrorism. But then why is it that the US and the UK spend their whole time talking about the LRA and the terrorism threat to Uganda in the 2000s, when from a more objective perspective, Kenya is under much more threat? So it's kind of counterintuitive to some extent, and I guess plays into the fact that this is about building narratives rather than necessarily reflecting the situation on the ground. One thing I would also say is the fact that there's a delegation here from the Kenyan embassy, but not the Ugandan, perhaps perhaps also says something about Kenya's approach to managing its image compared to Uganda. So that's an interesting interesting thing to observe.
I make a slight observation that I think your analysis, as we were talking before we came in here, is a little out of date because since 2008 and the formation of the Government of National Unity, I would say that the Kenyans have actually been rather more effective at their news management than the Ugandans have. It's a very, very different story up to 2007, where Uganda, for example, here had a very dynamic ambassador from 96 to 2006, the Kenyans less so. Now, I would say probably the Kenyan ambassador was more dynamic than the Ugandan. The Ugandans had three PR companies representing their interests here in Washington. Those now seem to have fallen by the wayside. The Kenyans have a PR company, really, I think, for the first time, well, certainly one that is trying to reach out fairly energetically. I'm not sure how effective a job they're doing, but they do exist and they do keep churning out the stuff. So that is a fundamental transformation that has taken place in the last 4 years. And I'm wondering how far Raila is responsible for that as Prime Minister. If it's Raila who is repackaging the presentation of Kenya, which now, as I say, I think is superior, certainly here in Washington, I don't know about London, to the packaging of Uganda. And now Kenya has its intervention in Somalia, which, if they play it well and interpret it well, might change the whole ball game there as well.
Definitely, yeah.
We're just about at time. Is there... Yes.
I wanted to make a comment or a question
on the media
about casualties and maybe Kenya not giving the right picture, because this has maybe been coming up in other forums. Every week, the military is having briefs to say what is happening on the front line, and we have other medias there who are reporting on what is going on. So the issue of casualties really is not something which you can hide. It's just like you can't hide how many military people have died in Afghanistan or Iraq. I mean, it will be known. So you can't hide. So the issue of the casualties or whatever is not something which you can say you can hide. So whatever is given is the right figure. So there is no hiding about anything.
Except you have the problem that the figure given out by the government of Kenya doesn't correspond with the figure if you talk to the executive editor of The Nation or the executive editor of The Standard. They are saying we are employing a blackout, a voluntary blackout. We're not being compelled to do this by the government. We're doing this as part of our patriotic duty. But if you talk to them privately, they have a very different analysis of the number of casualties that have occurred inside Jubaland since mid-October than the official figure.
Okay, well, I think we'll not get into that. Unless there's a final question from the group. Yes, yes.
One more question. In your conversations with people, I feel I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up Ethiopia, and I think it has been brought up a couple of times. But it's fairly glaring that when you're talking about donors and CT and people getting a free pass, Ethiopia's pretty major in this regard. And you know, you understand the realities in terms of it being playing a role in Khartoum and South Sudan dialogue. But did anybody else bring up Ethiopia? And I would also ask, going back to what Sarah said, I think it's crucial in terms of the demand side, where would you see the demand, and where does it need to come from? Does it need to come from international organizations, in terms of human rights organizations, think tanks, et cetera, to try and break loose and decalcify? What I see is some of this sort of a policy that really hasn't had a good, strong rethink in a long time in terms of the real CT value. Like, we know who these groups are. What's the real CT value of Ethiopia, for example? How do you decalcify it? And so what would you suggest there?
Okay.
And can I also say, sorry to add, but you know, the UK, I believe, gives mostly budget support.
That's right. Yeah.
And it's very hard. It's more hard for the US to, I think, kind of say, okay, we're going to withhold, you know, PEPFAR funding or emergency food funding. But budget support, it seems like you may have more leverage.
Absolutely. And a part of the budget support story in this is that DFID was very, very reluctant to provide budget support to Kenya throughout the early 2000s, whereas it was completely the opposite in Uganda. It sort of piloted it in Uganda. So there's another contrast to draw in terms of consequences of these differing perceptions. Ethiopia and Meles are always brought up in my conversations as a sort of corollary to Museveni, as well as Kagame. And I would probably say that there's a paper in comparing the way in which they engage with international actors and what they've learnt from each other. I mean, they all emerged in the same sort of sociological background, guerrilla movements, trying to sort of present a political programme whilst fighting for power. And there are a lot of similarities between how they engage, what sort of things they say. Meles has always been talking about the sort of Talibanization of Somalia for a while and jihadist sort of stuff, and he's very good and very skilled. And every event I've been to, every Africanist event I've been to in London has had someone from the Ethiopian embassy there. So they are certainly important. But they're more of a soft case for this sort of study because they clearly have a very great importance in terms of Somalia and counter-terrorism just from the fact that they've been so involved in Somalia. So it's less of a contrast to draw, I think, in why donors think of them as so important. In terms of the demand side, I think that, it would be depend on what policymakers read, I suppose, and where they inform themselves. But from what I can tell, they read a lot of ICG and Human Rights Watch stuff as terms of external stuff. So that would certainly be an area where there would be room for, trying to reframe the narratives. Yeah.
Well, listen, thanks very much. I think that's very kind of thought-provoking. I think great comments and questions.
Yeah, it was really, really interesting.
And look forward to the paper you have, your paper on the Ugandan intervention
in Somalia,
there.
Yeah.
In Somalia. So please join me in thanking Jonathan.